This is the 16th annual C.S. Lewis lecture. C.S. Lewis was and remains, through his writings, a potent apologist for the Christian faith. In a century in which Christianity and academe have often been at odds, the purpose of this lecture series is to bring speakers to campus who are able to communicate the message of Christianity in the tradition of C.S. Lewis. In the past, speakers have ranged from Nobel Prize finalist chemist to professors of literature. However, it is difficult to imagine a speaker more uniquely qualified to speak in the Lewis tradition than our speaker this evening. Douglas Gresham became Lewis's stepson at the age of 10 and lived with him until Lewis passed away when Doug was 18. The recent stage and movie productions of Shadowlands, which dramatized the moving story of Lewis and Doug's mother, Joy Davidson Gresham, have given many of us brief glimpses into Doug's childhood. He even contends that some of those glimpses are actually accurate.
Excuse me.
In addition to this personal experience, and among his many other accomplishments, including being a very fine writer in his own right, Doug is an authority of Lewis's writings and thought. Doug Gresham's life defies easy summary, so I'm not even going to try. Suffice it to say that he currently lives in Ireland, where he and his wife, Mary, operate Rathvinden Ministries. Their large home is based on activities that focus on the training of therapists dealing with clients who have suffered pregnancy loss, including loss due to abortion and child abuse. In addition, they have opened their home for many other purposes related to their commitment to serve Christ with their lives. We appreciate his willingness to come to Chattanooga to speak with us this evening. Join with me in welcoming to Chattanooga and to UTC, Douglas Gresham.
Don't applaud, I haven't said anything yet. First thing I should tell you is that any wisdom you hear from my lips comes to you from the Holy Spirit of God. The folly is entirely my own, and may he grant you the discernment to tell the one from the other. 100 years ago, in November of this year, a baby was born in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. He was called Clive Staples Lewis. I don't think he really deserved it. But at about the age of 4, a little dog that he was fond of in the neighborhood, whose name was Jaxie, was run over. And Clive came home that day deciding that he would never more be Clive, but he would be Jaxie from ever after. It soon transmogrified itself into Jax, and then Jack later on in life, which is why those who have played Shadowlands and those who have watched Shadowlands will know that the character is usually called Jack. He was an exceptional child, very exceptional child. He wrote his first analytical notes of Milton's Paradise Lost when he was 9 years old. He had an incredible intelligence, which soon became evident. In fact, he was far too intelligent for the schools he was sent to, one of which was a Dickensian horror, and the others of which were just weren't very good. So he eventually wound up being sent to a private tutor called Kirkpatrick, after whom, by the way, is named Professor Kirk in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Kirkpatrick was an atheist, and he was a rationalist. And very soon, the young Jack began to lose any attachment he ever had to a Christian faith. He slid slowly from a nominalism into agnosticism, and thence into the darkness of atheism. However, he pursued a career at university after his tutorage under Kirkpatrick, and he took a triple first from Oxford, when he was yet a very young man. He fought in the First World War as a volunteer in the Somerset Light Infantry and had some horrific experiences. He saw things in the war which gave him nightmares for the rest of his life. Now, the First World War was an interesting one, a unique war, in that it is the only war in history in which the soldiers have not gone to the battlefield, fought their battle, and then gone away again. In the First World War, the soldiers went to the battlefield and lived there for months and sometimes if they survive, for years. In the blood-soaked mud, up to their necks sometimes. Rats, lice, and all of those horrible things. And yet, Jack regarded that as not the worst experience of his life. His school days, he thought, were even worse. I hope that none of the students who are here today would agree with that. But all through this, slowly but surely, the immense intellect of the man and the high intelligence of the man became evident. As I say, he took a triple first from Oxford. He became, eventually, a fellow of Magdalen College, Oxford. And one of his first students was a young man of 23 years of age. And Jack said to him, "How old are you?" Jack being a pretty young tutor. And the student replied, "Sir, I'm 23. And Jack said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And the student said, "Why, sir?" And he said, "Because you will never again read for the first time any of the great classics of literature." He assumed that because by the time he was 23, he had read all the great classics of literature in their original languages, that other students had done the same. It didn't take him long to find out that this was not the case. His immense intellect made him a very good teacher and a very good tutor. But he found that there was an emptiness in his life. There was a great gap in the middle of it. He had read all the great literature. He had read all the great myths of ancient Greece. He'd read the histories of ancient Rome. His education was absolutely immense by today's standards. And yet, there was something missing. And he couldn't put his finger on what it was. But slowly, throughout all his reading, he was forced into the conclusion that there had to be something more than simply this world. The amazing faith of atheists always amazes me, and it also astonished Jack. Because atheists believe that this world is an accident of something called nature. The coincidences that would have to happen for that to take place are astronomic in their number, and far beyond my ability to believe. Jack, sooner or later, came under the impression that there had to be a plan. There had to be a creator. And he stumbled from the pitch darkness of atheism into the dim, dimly lit cavern of theism. He realized there had to be somebody up there who was in control, who had designed all of this wondrousness that we see around us every day of our lives. He met good Christian... I've lost my microphone. Please. Can we try and do something about that? I will try to project in the meantime. But I've been speaking for the past week, so if my voice gives out halfway, don't be surprised. Can you hear me at the back? Good. Jack began slowly, through all his reading and his talking with other dons at Oxford, to become aware of this character called Jesus Christ. And he rationalized it. He approached it with his impeccable logic. And he worked around it, desperately trying to avoid the presence of this being. First of all, trying to avoid God himself. And secondly, trying to avoid ever having to admit that Jesus was the Son of God. And then one day, he got into the sidecar of a Dordal motorcycle, a make which is no longer in existence, driven by his brother Warney. And they drove to Whipsnade Zoo, which in those days was a very new zoo. And Jack said later on that when he got into the sidecar, he did not believe that Jesus was the Son of God. But when he got out at the other end, he did. No one is quite sure what the procedure was or the influences were that convinced him of this. I always blame Warney. But in any case, he suddenly stumbled out of that dim cavern of theism into the blinding light of true Christianity. Now, the first thing I wanted to explain was the power of his intellect. Let me explain to you that Jack and my mother, who had very similar intellectual abilities, used to play the game Scrabble, of which I'm sure you're familiar. Scrabble is a word game, and you get so many tiles. Do you know the game Scrabble? I'm preaching to the choir. Anyway, they would take two Scrabble sets, one board and two sets of letters, and they would play Scrabble in all known languages. Factual or fictional. as long as the person could prove that the word concerned had actually been used in print. For this reason, words like Nazgul were available, Orkish from Tolkien, Ming Chinese, all of these things were available. And they would fill the Scrabble board until there were no gaps left. These people had the most staggering intellect of anyone I have yet encountered. One was my mother, and the other was Jack himself. Both of them were forced, through the power of their intellect, into the realization that the gospel of Jesus Christ is true. Now, many young people whom I meet today are seemingly staggering throughout the world, asking people questions, trying to find out what would be the best thing to believe. They are searching for something. Our society today has so assigned itself to materialism and to nonsense, quite frankly, that they are searching for what would be best for them to believe, what would be the right thing for them to believe in their circumstances. And I always tell them the same thing. I said, instead of looking for what is best for you to believe, why don't you search for the truth? Because if you search for the truth, you will find it. One of the most common questions I'm asked is, what do you think C.S. Lewis, were he alive today, would think of this issue or that issue? The churches all love to claim him. The Roman Catholics keep saying to me, well, of course, if Jack were alive today, he would have become one of us. And then the Baptists say, of course, if Jack was still alive, he would have become one of us. Now, the Mormons, I believe, have baptized him in absentia. But the truth of the matter was that Jack was not given to isms at all, but was instead a mere Christian. He described himself as the last of the dinosaurs, the last of the old Western men. A man steeped in the traditions of Celtic mythology, Greek mythology, Roman mythology. He was aware of the myths of the East, and he set them all aside as man's attempts to find God, whereas Christianity was God's attempt to contact man. People ask me, what would Jack think of this issue or that issue were he alive today? And I'm always very reluctant to express any sort of opinion on those matters, because without giving him the grace of the 30-odd years since his death of life, I have no idea what he would think. However, of one thing I am convinced, and that is that were he brought back into today's society suddenly from beyond the grave, he would think he was dead and living in hell. The role of a Christian pastor is that of comforting the disturbed in his parish. I have the misfortune to be usually cast in the role of a biblical-style prophet, one who expounds the word of God. And the role of a prophet is to disturb the comfortable. Because if you are a Christian in today's world and you are comfortable with that, you have got it wrong. You cannot watch what is happening in the world today. You cannot watch what is happening in American society today and be comfortable as a Christian. You cannot watch what is happening to children in today's world. I am involved in my ministry at home in post-child abuse trauma therapy. You cannot hear the stories of the middle-aged people who have been ritually abused, the middle-aged people who have been abused by emotional neglect. You cannot hear these things and live with these people and be comfortable as a Christian in today's world. You cannot live in an America where the current regime is responsible for the deaths of more Americans than Adolf Hitler and be comfortable as a Christian. It makes no matter whether the people who are killed have yet been born. You cannot justify infanticide on the grounds of the youth of the victim. And you cannot justify euthanasia on the grounds of the age of the victim. And it is a very, very short step indeed from abortion and infanticide to euthanasia. Jack, coming here today, were he to watch television, if he were to read the newspapers, if he were to see the things that are happening every day in the streets of our cities, in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, America, Australia, he could not be comfortable as a Christian in today's society. And I'm here to tell you that if you are comfortable in this society, you had better think again about your orientation. Jack set out to do what he could to show what was happening, what he could see was going to happen to the society in which we live. If you have read his works, you'll find a staggeringly prophetic quality about them. Books like The Abolition of Man, books like That Hideous Strength. Now, I am not familiar with what is happening in the secular universities of America, but I can tell you that when I visit some of the secular universities of England, I find some of the characters from That Hideous Strength walking beside me to the dinner table, and I shudder. That is not to say that there aren't wonderful people in the academic worlds of all these great countries. That is not to say that there are not wonderful Christians in America, because there are many of them. America is a country of enormous contrasts. I went to do a talk in Atlanta some years ago and was surrounded by wonderful Christian people in that great city. When I got back to my hotel, I went to the bar to have a Coca-Cola, and within 3 minutes was propositioned by three different prostitutes. It is a land of enormous contrast in moral values. Jack, if he had come back today, would think he was living in hell. It's interesting to try to imagine Jack's take on modern culture. And I have the terrible feeling that if I were at the dinner table with Jack today, he would look at me and say, "Well, I told you so." Because he did tell us so, justifiably. And Jack was not one to bandy words. I remember one time when I was about 12, seeking some sort of approbation, I suppose, I said to Jack at the dinner table, "You know, Jack, I think my greatest sin would probably be pride." And he looked at me with a twinkle in his eye and he said, "Yes, I think I'd agree with you." Talk about a squash. His writing is his legacy to us. And what we do with it will be our legacy to future generations. Jack was one of those who stood out against the secularization of education. He stood out against the corruption of society, and he made himself very unpopular in doing it. He was passed over for promotion year after year at more than Oxford. Eventually, he went to Cambridge and was given the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature. He was given it because they created it for him with him in mind, and there he found the real Christianity that was missing in Oxford. I think it's important that we look at what it means to be a Christian. What is Christianity? What is Christianity according to Jack's writings? Well, to start with, I ask people often, "Are you a Christian?" And they will say to me, "Yes, I'm a Christian. I was baptized." So was Adolf Hitler. He didn't smoke either. And he didn't drink. He didn't even cuss. Well, Jack smoked, and Jack drank. I'm sure you've all heard of Bob Jones, who founded Bob Jones University. But Bob Jones was a Southerner. And Bob Jones came across to England to meet C.S. Lewis. And when he got back to America, somebody said, "Well, Bob, you met C.S. Lewis." Bob said, "Yes, I did." And the guy said, "Well, what did you think of him?" And he said, "Well, that man smokes tobacco. And that man drinks alcohol. But you know, I think that man's a Christian." There is a tendency in today's Christian world to concentrate on the trivial at the expense of the essential. What does it mean to be a Christian? You ask other people the same question and they'll say, "Yeah, I'm a Christian, all right, I believe in God and I believe in Jesus." So does Satan. He believes in God and he believes in Jesus. He knows the truth, and he and all his demons shudder in fear. Other people say, "Yeah, well, I lead a Christian life. You know, I give to World Vision and the Salvation Army and stuff like that." A friend of mine, a speaker in Australia, whose name is Roland Croucher, was once asked to be the keynote speaker at an Assemblies of Brethren in Tasmania leadership conference. Now, I don't know how the Assemblies of Brethren churches are in America, but in Tasmania, they were big black Bibles, Dave Wilkerson suits, and severe expressions dudes, you know. And they tried very hard not to laugh in case anyone would think they were being frivolous. And they tried not to smile if there was a member of the opposite sex close by in case people were thinking they were being flirtatious. And I was an Anglican observer. I used to be an Anglican, by the way, but now I'm a Christian. Thank you. I get great responses to that in Anglican churches when I'm preaching, believe me. But I was asked to be, as an Anglican synodsman at the time, I was asked to go along as an Anglican observer. And I saw Roland Croucher stand up in front of all of these people, these severe black Bible expression people, and say, I want you to sit down and write down five good things you can think of to say about the Pharisees in the New Testament. And they did. They wrote down things like, well, they were prayerful. They prayed regularly. They knew the Bible. They read their scriptures. They gave to the poor religiously and regularly. They obeyed the laws, and so on. When they had their five most popular comments about the Pharisees, they wrote them up, well, Roland wrote them up on a blackboard. And then he said, now, I'd like you to just consider amongst yourselves and ask the following question. Do these sets of characteristics remind you of anything? Sure enough, three or four of the elders of this leadership conference put up their hands. They all agreed that it reminded them of their church. And Roland said, congratulations, Jesus says you are the children of Satan. And had there been someone dropping half a pin on the floor, you would have heard it bounce. Because he went on to say, you have forgotten the divine justice, mercy, and love of God and Jesus Christ in your church and become bound over with legalism. And in that one weekend, we witnessed that entire church leadership conference become a charismatic, spirit-filled healing ministry. It's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen in my life. What does it mean to be a Christian? What did C.S. Lewis teach us that means to be a Christian? Now, he taught me, I guess I have an unfair advantage. I've read his books, but he taught me far more by simply living in the house where I was, by being the last of the dinosaurs. Because he not only believed in Christ and in God, but he believed Christ. He not only believed in him, but he believed what he said and what he taught, and he lived that belief. If you want to be a Christian, I don't recommend it if you're a coward. And I don't recommend it if you're a wimp either. Because Christianity is not for cowards or wimps. It is the greatest challenge a human being can accept. You see, Christianity will demand of you your emotional energy. It will demand of you your physical energy. It will demand of you financially. It will demand of you your intellectual energy. And most of all, it will demand the one thing that you can never replenish, and that is your time. If you want to be a Christian, the way C.S. Lewis wrote Christianity and the way Jesus taught Christianity, it will demand of you your life. And why should it not? Because Jesus bought it with his. You see, what Jack believed and what Jack taught is that the God who created all things existent made man to find himself loving and willing, faithful friends. And we betrayed him in the Garden of Eden. So, God, not being vindictive, but being just and merciful, tried again. He addressed a man called Abram. And Abram believed God and was credited to him as righteousness. And he did what he was told. But of course, being Jewish, I can say stuff like this. The Israelites backed away from it because they're argumentative people. Let's face it. If you want a lawyer, get a Jewish one. We're great at that kind of stuff. They backed away and went back to worshipping idols and pursuing the despicable practices of burning their children in the altars of Moloch. They're unwanted babies. So God tried again. He let them be captured into captivity with the Egypt's regime, Egypt's Pharaoh's empire. And then he sent to Moses. And he drew them out of Egypt. And he gave them another chance. And he even went so far as to inscribe in stone the basic rules for running the human race as a species and running the human race as individuals. And by the time Moses got down the mountain, they'd already built an idol. And in fury, Moses broke the tablets, and God said, oh, no, here we go again. So he made him another set. And Moses came back down, and he led the people. And Moses was a pretty cluey gent. Tony Campolo puts it very well. Tony remembers as a child he had a Jewish friend. When they went to school, Tony's mother would say, Tony, have you got your lunch? And the Jewish mother would say, Jaime, have you got your books? And as Tony says, he got fatter, and the Jewish guy got smarter. But God tried again. Moses, knowing it wasn't good enough to have only 10 commandments for the Jewish folks, because we're a very legalistic people, wrote out a lot of good stuff in communion with God, and we had the Moses laws, the Mosaic laws, the Talmud. And for a while, the Jews obeyed, 40 years in the wilderness. Eventually, they got to the promised land, and they settled in. They conquered the nations there that were there already, and they settled in. And then they slid back into worshipping the idols, sacrificing their children on the altars of Moloch, and all of that sort of hideousness. And God, almost despairing, sent prophets to tell them what to do. Jonah, for example, who went to Nineveh and said, look, if you don't repent, the city will be destroyed. Much to Jonah's disgust, they did repent. I mean, he went out and sulked. He wanted to see some fire and brimstone. He's very disappointed. But after a while, after each prophet, they slid back into their old ways. If you study the book of Kings, you'll find that time and time again, a good king comes up and they follow God and then they slide right back again. And eventually they started to stone the prophets and reject God's word. Now, God is a just being, and he is also infinitely just and infinitely merciful at the same time. You could not be infinitely just without feeling immense anger at mankind. But in mercy, we could not, for example, punish a handicapped child for not being healthy. No more could God punish us directly for being a failed species. So what did he do with his immense anger, his holy anger? He came here himself and had himself made into the perfect man. And then he took out his anger on himself as Jesus Christ and had himself nailed to a cross in the most agonizing torture that man has ever devised. And he died for us on that cross, an ungrateful mankind. More than that, we often look, we Christians look at the crucifixion from Jesus' viewpoint, and we bewail that this had to happen for us. But we forget that there was a Father watching from above, his only begotten, perfect child, being tortured to death. And at the very last moment, he withdrew his protection and his contact with that child. As Jesus cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was alone on that cross, dying for you and dying for me. And God above looked down and watched his son die for an ungrateful mankind. That's the Christianity that Jesus taught. And that is the Christianity that C.S. Lewis wrote in his books, Mere Christianity, in The Great Divorce, in The Screwtape Letters. We find the same recurring message. This was done for you and for me. If we had to try to bring C.S. Lewis into contemporary culture, he would not fit. If we had the power to bring him back, it would be the unkindest and cruelest thing we could do to him. Since he died, we have so changed the world for the worse that I think he would consider himself to be living in hell were he here today. And it is my generation that have done this. When I'm speaking to students, I usually make a habit of apologizing. I am sorry that we have so destroyed, polluted, and damaged this planet in which you have to live. I am sorry that we have created political famines, wars, strife, and terror for you to deal with, because you have to change it. You are the hope, the only hope that mankind has. And if in this nation, incidentally, a curiosity about America is that in the state scholarly institutions and the schools of this country, you can teach homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle if you want. You can teach Buddhism as an alternative lifestyle if you want. You can teach Islam as an alternative lifestyle if you want. You can teach anything you like as long as it is not Christianity. And that is perfectly logical, because Satan does not have to attack those whom he already controls. He only has to attack the Christians. Now, if you make the decision to become a Christian, you will set yourself up, just as C.S. Lewis did, as a target for Satan and his demons. You see, if you are in a prisoner of war camp, along with thousands of other prisoners, the commandant of that camp doesn't worry for one second about the prisoners he has safely under lock and key doing what they're supposed to be doing. Why should he? But if one of you prisoners cuts the wire and heads for the tall timber and escapes, he will then send every dog, every gun, and every soldier he has to bring you back. If you commit your life to Christ, Satan will send everything he has after you. Now, C.S. Lewis committed his life to Christ, and not only did he preach Christianity, and not only did he teach Christianity, and not only did he write Christianity, but he lived Christianity. And being isolated on a pinnacle of immense intellectual ability and intelligence, probably the greatest mind this 20th century has seen, he was totally alone on this pinnacle. And then, from that strange country across the Atlantic Ocean, came letters from an American lady. Letters that were well written, letters that searched out little holes, little weaknesses in his writings, which he delightedly answered. And then the lady herself came to England, as many of you will have seen in Shadowlands. It's depicted very well. You may remember that lovely scene in the hotel where Deborah Winger says, "Anybody here called Lewis?" Incidentally, there's an added member of the audience here in front of me. There's a spider crawling all over the microphone. I hope he doesn't have too much to say, but don't worry, it's not a black widow. And this lady came into C.S. Lewis's life, and he discovered that there was someone else on the same pinnacle of intellectual ability. My mother took her degree from, I think, Columbia University before she was 20 years old. She was an exceptional mind. She was one of those people who not only had great intelligence, but shared another thing in common with Jack. She had a total recall memory. Jack had developed the ability, or the inability, to ever forget anything he had read. Now, that sounds kind of strange when you think about it, particularly as the man had read almost everything. But people would challenge him on it, and he'd say, "Okay, go to the shelf and pick a book," and they would reach for the most dusty book they could find. They'd blow the dust off it, and Jack would say, "Open it at a page at random," and they would. He'd say, "Now read me the first line." It was usually some obscure medieval poem they would look out. They would read the first line, and Jack would start to quote, and he would keep quoting the poem until they told him to stop. Now, my mother could pick up a book of a score of a complicated piano concerto by Chopin or something, read it, put it down, and then go and play it on the piano. They both shared this incredible intellectual and memory ability. So these two unique people met, and I don't think there was any possibility that they would not fall in love. They became great friends. Now, I suppose I should talk to some extent tonight about the nature of love itself. We only have one word for it in English, and for those of you who've heard me address this before this visit, I apologize, but you're just going to put up with it again. In ancient Greek, they had four words for love, and Jack wrote a book, indeed, called The Four Loves. In fact, they had five. But because he was doing this as a recording session for the Episcopal Radio and Television Foundation of Atlanta, Georgia, he could not go into the fifth one. In fact, when he started talking about Eros, they said, "Look, we're sorry, we can't broadcast this because in your passage on Eros, you talked about sex." And Jack said, "Well, I could hardly describe Eros without talking about sex." But in any case, the progression of love between human beings must start with agape, as the Greeks called it, which is the first form of love, that natural love from God flowing through one human being to another. It is that emotion that makes you rush out and pick up a hurt child in the street. Although in this country, you can't do that anymore, you'd get sued, wouldn't you? I'm sorry. It's that emotion that causes firemen to plunge into a burning building to save children from burning to death. It is the natural love of God flowing through you to another human being. It is that emotion that makes you weep when you watch Shadowlands, because you empathize and you share the grief and the pain of the people in the spirit. And that's even better. That's fiction, most of it. That is agape. And when you have met a human being and this agape has taken place, the next form of love to develop should be philia, love of friendship, shared interests, common interests, shared differences. Just that sense of, what, you two? I've read this, you've read that, you like that? That is philia. And when philia has become firmly established, a third form of love comes into play, and that is storge. Storge is the love, or need love, the love of the familiar. And anyone who's ever lost a favorite dog will know what that's all about. Or a favorite pair of slippers, for that matter. But it is that love which makes you feel an empty hole inside your being when someone with whom you're close goes away somewhere and nothing else can fill that gap. When all three of those loves are firmly in place, and only then, should Eros, the romantic love between man and woman, be allowed to show its ugly head. Another thing that Tony Campolo tells us is that he's a Baptist minister as well as being a professor of sociology. And because of that, some of his students often come to him and they say, excuse me, Dr. Campolo, we want to get married. And they want him to do the wedding. And he says, why? And he says, as Tony puts it, they look at each other like dying cows in a hailstorm. I don't know where Tony gets his imagery from, but it's great stuff. And they say, because we're in love. And Tony says, don't you have a better reason? Because what they're describing is romance. And romance is when the chemistry is right. There is no basis for it. It is not rooted in any solidity. And romance does not last. In fact, one of the best ways of killing romance is to get married. And incidentally, I've been married for 31 years. Hi, little fella. He's gone back up to the microphone. In any case, romance will not last. And when we have a marriage guidance problem, when someone comes to us and says, look, I have a real problem. I've fallen in love with someone other than my wife. All we have to say is wait 6 months. It goes away. And it does. So romance is a very bad basis for a marriage. But if you have agape, philia, and storge in place, and then the romance emerges, that is the basis for a marriage. And once that marriage has taken place, then Venus, the sexual love between man and woman, can be allowed to happen. And that, of course, unites you as one flesh. A very interesting thing I discovered from a researcher at the Lejeune Institute in Paris a while ago who was staying in our home. That is that there, when Jesus said 2,000 years ago, you become one flesh, he wasn't kidding. There are apparently 13 hormonal compounds absorbed through the vaginal walls from the seminal plasma of the male ejaculation into the female bloodstream, and they stay there for life. And the doctors who discovered this at the Lejeune Institute said to themselves, wow, how did Jesus know this? And the answer was that he made man. You ought to know how it works. One of the things that Jack pointed out in his writings is that we have been given the instruction manual on how to run the human race. Now, I was a farmer for many years, and I frequently bought new machinery. And you always get a maker's instruction book. And with a tractor, for example, it will say things like, keep your oil clean, do not let dust or sand get into the oil or fuel. And if you throw a handful of sand into the sump of a car or a tractor, within about a day or so, you will not have an engine anymore. The Bible is very simply the maker's instruction book on how to run the human race. And God says to us, don't do this because it is bad for you. The instructions we have in the Bible, the don'ts and the do's, are all to our good. I have been able to discover all kinds of interesting things. God, for example, tells the Jewish people to go for long periods of time not consuming anything with yeast in it. I always thought that was a bit weird, until I started to die some years ago. And I'm not joking about that. I very nearly did die. It turned out I had what is known as a Candida albicans overrun, systemic candidiasis. I was dying because my system was being taken over by yeast. And I now cannot eat anything with yeast in it. Which means, of course, I can't drink anything with yeast in it. Or made from yeast. Which is a little bit of a regret at times. God wasn't kidding when he wrote the instructions of how to run the human race. Now Jack, this great intellect, who had been an atheist, my mother, who had not only been an atheist here in America, in New York, she was from the Bronx, but had also been a communist. At that time, it was fairly straightforward. You either were a communist and tried to save the world, or you were a fascist and tried to conquer the world. But of course, the hollowness and emptiness of that philosophy soon came home to her intelligence, and she deserted it. My father, incidentally, William Lindsay Gresham, who was also a novelist, and had a way with words, who had been a communist and also got out of the party, once said that communists aren't necessarily more stupid than other people, they're simply prouder of it. But these two great minds coming together, these were people whose intelligence was probably, I have never seen it exceeded. I have never seen anyone who I could even put on the same pinnacle of intelligence and intellectual ability as these two. They came to the conclusion that Jesus Christ was God made man, and he died for us. Now, from a logical viewpoint, if someone as brainy as Jack and as brainy as my mother found this to be the case, who the dickens am I to argue? The greatest minds I have ever met have been Christian minds. The greatest egos I have ever met have been scientists and other people who have missed his truth. And I am pretty egotistical. I made my living for some years as a professional radio and television personality. I was gifted by God with this strange voice. And when I say you should go out and buy Blogs Ale, people go out and buy Blogs Ale. My broadcasting career was extremely successful. In fact, the highlight of it was, and it's still remembered to this day in the city of Perth in Western Australia, that I'm the man who sold 2,000 tons of chicken manure in 6 weeks to an urban population. I think what really comes out of that, you know, is that people who give up believing in God fall for anything. And you will see it in every society in the Western civilization, euphemistically called civilization today, where people religiously read their horoscopes, and they believe that garbage. A lovely incident happened in Launceston, Tasmania. An ad appeared in the paper which said, the well-known clairvoyant, Madam such-and-such, will be arriving in Launceston for readings, you know, in the next 6 weeks or something. And about a week later, an ad followed it saying, due to unforeseen circumstances... I found it was absolutely amazing. I've met many people who are brilliantly intelligent, but for some reason have missed the fact that you shouldn't look in the world for what you want to believe in. You shouldn't look for the world to try to find out what's right for you to believe in this period of history. But you should search for the truth. If you search for the truth, you will eventually find it. And if you don't know what it is yet, go looking for it. One of the other things I want to tell you that I believe Jack would go along with is that we have completely ruined what success means in our society. Well, I think I've probably been talking long enough. I would be very glad if you'd like to ask any questions about Narnia, about Jack's other fiction or about his other works, or indeed about anything else that you think I might be able to help you with. How we better do this, I think. Can you... somebody?
Just a brief interjection.
That's okay.
I didn't. If the students who have the response cards sort of make their way down, and we'll pass those out as we start into question and answers, and do that as unobtrusively as possible when you're going to have to climb over people. However, that's going to work. Also, I have an announcement. If there's a Deborah Blake in the house, if you would make your way to the lobby, there's an usher there with a message for you that's kind of important. Deborah Blake. And now, if I'm just going to let Doug handle the questions and answers. You'll need to project so that we can hear your questions, and we'll repeat them if the rest of you can't. So.
If you'd like to speak, put your hand up if you have a question. Speak very loudly, because I'm getting hard of hearing after years on tractors and motorbikes. I'll start here, please. What this generation has lost, what I'm apologizing for, the younger generation, I'm apologizing that we ever created the situation that made abortion seem like an optional extra. I'm apologizing that the Christian churches ever attached a stigma to pregnancy outside of wedlock or inside wedlock so that people think it is a shameful thing to be pregnant. I'm here to tell you that any girl who has been careless with her affections is no less guilty of sin and no more guilty of sin than every single one of us in this hall tonight. And most of us have sinned far more grievously in our pride than that young lady has. But we Christian churches have attached this stigma to pregnancy, and I apologize for that. I apologize that I have not done enough to prevent it. I work with people who have been in the post-abortion trauma problems, and I apologize to them because I didn't stop them from having an abortion. I apologize to you that your world is polluted, because I have not done enough to stop people from polluting it. I apologize to you that we have allowed education in this country to make Christianity a dirty word, because it is the only hope for your society. If you do not get Christianity back into your universities, back into your primary schools, back into your secondary schools, back into your workplaces, into your offices, into your businesses, your society is doomed. And I apologize that we have allowed that to happen. I could probably go on for ages, but I think you get the message. Thank you. There was a young lady here. I think probably the latter is, he did probably think it was something I had to learn on my own to a certain extent. But he taught me by example. Jack didn't preach at me. I think he realized that had he preached at me, he would have turned me away. But we are not commissioned as Christians to convert people to Christianity. We are told to spread the good news of the gospel of Christ. What you do with it is between you and the Holy Spirit of God. So I think Jack simply told me the truth and then let me get on with it. It just was unfortunate that I was such a slow learner. Thank you. Yes, sir. Well, I won't take them piecemeal, but yes, there are things he wrote that I disagree with. Mostly and principally, I think I disagree with his theories about pain. He expressed pain as being something that God inflicts upon us for our own good, and I don't believe that to be the case. I believe rather that pain is something that Satan inflicts upon us to attempt to turn us away from God and to make us blame God for it. All human relationships will end in pain. The pain of bereavement, for example, which many of us have experienced. You see, pain is the kind of goods and services tax which our fallen nature has allowed Satan to place on God's free gift of love. And the deeper and richer and more loving the relationship, the greater will be the pain at its passing. But don't ever devalue that, because the pain itself has immense value. It is by that pain that we can gauge the depth of our love. That's one point of Jack's. Just there are some things he wrote that I disagree with. I disagree with his stand on not ordaining women in the priesthood, for example. I was a part of the debate in the Anglican Synod as to whether or not to ordain women priests. And I started from Jack's viewpoint, and through studying the scriptures and watching the debates and taking part in the debates, and watching the movement against the ordination of women slowly turn to the tactics of Satan, they started to use deception, vituperation in public of good and holy men. I realized that Satan was trying to stop that church from ordaining women. And I said to the rest of the assembly that if Satan is trying to stop us, we should do it straight away. In the end, that vote was carried 75% in favor of ordaining women. There are several things that Jack wrote that I disagree with. Partially, I think, because I am a member of this particular generation and not of his particular generation. It is fairly important to take into account the mores of the society in which Jack was brought up and the mores of the society in which he lived and worked to try to understand what some of the things he wrote meant. There are people who labor under the misapprehension that Jack was a misogynist. Nothing could be further from the truth. They get it from his writings because they read it with a 1990s attitude instead of a 1930s attitude when it was written. Jack was a man who voluntarily surrounded himself with women. He was never a misogynist. But it seems that way if you put a 1990s political correct slant on what he wrote. It simply doesn't work. So there are things that I did disagree with and do disagree with in Jack's writings. He had his faults and failings. That doesn't mean, of course, that I'm any corrector than he was, but I have my failings, obviously, too. He was a human being, and he was fallible, so obviously one must disagree with some of his writings. But thank you for the question. Please. Yes. Sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. That means he took an honors degree, if I can get this right. I only wrote it in my unpublished biography of him a short while ago. He took an honors degree in classics. That is the Greek philosophers and the Greek literature and the Roman philosophers and literature. He took an honors degree in English. He took an honors degree in philosophy. Sir. Yes.
You guys in the back, did you hear the question?
The question was, is the Bible the authoritative and inspired Word of God? My answer was yes. Lady at the back here. I don't know of one. I think Jack's writing is unique. Unless it be me, of course. Sir, with the red tie. Sorry, could you speak up? Oh, it's great to meet you. Yeah, come down and say hello afterwards. I'd love to talk to you. I think the internet makes use of me, actually, but... Well, let me tell you first that correspondence was the bane of his existence. He had to answer thousands of letters, I'm sure you're aware. And, in fact, my files are so full now that I'm probably reaching somewhat of a similar total. But I think he was a man who was, in a sense, a technophobe. He wrote his books with a dip pen and a bottle of ink. He never even graduated to a fountain pen, let alone a ballpoint. I started by writing my book with a ballpoint, so I started steps ahead of Jack. But he wouldn't ever learn to type. He had a deformity of the thumb. The top joint of his thumb didn't bend at all. And that made some certain things very difficult for him to do. Because of that, he always regarded himself as clumsy. Warney, on the other hand, did learn to type, but he only used his two forefingers. If you have a letter from C.S. Lewis which is typed, it was written by Warney and then taken to Jack for his approval and signature. But if it's handwritten, it would be from Jack. Most of Jack's letters are characteristic by being very, very brief, because he answered dozens of letters every single day. He had the policy of answering every letter that was written to him, except those from the obvious lunatics and those that were anonymously sent. And I try to do the same thing. But I don't think he'd have got involved with the internet at all. Please, sir, over here. My favorite of all Jack's works is Till We Have Faces. Till We Have Faces. It is a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, and here is a classic illustration of the difference between English culture and American culture. The Americans have made a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche also, Walt Disney's Beauty and the Beasts. Jack did Till We Have Faces out of it. The reason I think it is a wonderful book is that I have probably read it 8 or 9 times, and every time I come back to it, it is a fresh book. There are multiple layers of depth, multiple layers of meaning to be discovered in that book. The first time you read it, and I read it first when I was about 13 or 14 years old, I was 14. It is a retelling, a vibrant retelling, an exciting adventure story of a myth. The next time you read it, you begin to perceive that there are deeper meanings you didn't see the first time. And that goes on every time you read it. And as I say, on Mere Lewis, as Dick Shear will probably remember, there are people who have read it 9, 10 times and are still finding new material in it, new meanings, new depths, as I also do. I think it's probably one of the greatest books ever written. It is Till We Have Faces. I'm looking for an... Oh, please, in the red. You say the crisis in the public school systems. I'm compelled to ask, which one? I mean, the whole system is in crisis. It is imploding on itself. I said only yesterday, I think, that I have traveled around the world more times than I can remember. And one of my other sins is that I'm a yachtsman, and I have sailed boats in the Coral Sea. And all of the very best balanced, best socially adjusted, best socially interactive, best educated children I have ever met have been homeschooled. And there are two pieces of advice I give young people who are about to have children. One is, first and foremost, take your television set to a multi-story car park, check that there's no one on the ground below, and heave it over the edge. And the second is hook into a good Christian homeschooling program and homeschool your children. Now, as a psychotherapist dealing with post-child abuse trauma, I can tell you that one of the reasons they are so brilliant, these children, is that they get the one-on-one parent-child relationship, which is so essential to the health and welfare of a child. The idea of putting your children in school and going to work all day, or putting your children in childcare and going off to work, I don't care what the financial necessities are, that is the abuse of that child's potential and the abuse of that child's psychology. Please. Could you say that again, please? Yes, I think he dealt with it extraordinarily well. But when you... I'm sorry, the question was, did I think that Jack dealt well with his own grief over my mother's death? And I think he did extraordinarily well. But you have to consider, as I said just a moment ago, that the deeper the love and the greater the love, the greater will be the pain at its ending, at the passing of that relationship. So he had found the one woman in the world for whom he'd probably been searching subconsciously all his life, and then she was snatched away by Satan. And he went into a paroxysm of grief. But let me tell you a small story here. There was a musician called Donald Swan who was writing an opera of Perelandra. And he had an appointment with Jack one summer day to come and discuss the libretto of this opera. And he arrived, and because it was a beautiful summer's day, Jack said, let's walk in the gardens while we discuss this. So they walked through the gardens for about an hour, hour and a half, discussing the libretto and the depths and details of the opera. And Jack finally said, well, I'm sorry, Donald. You must excuse me now. I must go. There are things I must do. My wife died last night. And he left Donald Swan stunned, and the librettist stunned in silence in the garden as he walked away, crippled with grief, into the house. Now, a man who was so tortured still had the courage and the perseverance to observe his obligation to those two men. Now, Jack sat down and he wrote a diary of his grief, and it became the book of Grief Observed, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But, you see, Warnie, who was a binge alcoholic, was of no support to Jack at that time, because he loved my mother as much as Jack did. He had found in her the sister he had always longed for. When she died, he hit the bottle, and he was completely blotto. The only person Jack had to lean on in his grief was me. And I was a 14-year-old child. But I had him to grieve to lean on in my grief. And I did better out of it than he did, obviously. I think he handled his grief immensely well, considering the pain he was in. He was one of the most courageous and bravest men I have ever met. And I hope that if such a thing ever befalls me, I will have the same kind of courage, though I doubt it. Please. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I was commissioned to write it. The lady asked about my unpublished biography of Jack and were there any plans to publish it. The answer is yes. I was originally commissioned to write it by a publisher, and I sent the first draft to them, and they wanted to make so many changes to the book that it would have turned into a book that I wouldn't want to write or be seen to having written. There are three reasons for writing books. One is that you hope it'll make you rich. The second is that you hope it'll make you famous. Now, I run a ministry and everything I have belongs to Jesus, so it doesn't really matter whether I get rich out of it or not. That's up to him. Secondly, I am probably more famous now than I actually enjoy being. I've been there before as a broadcaster, and I ducked out of it because I got sick of it and went back to farming and hid out on the farm for 13 years. But I realized when I went back into ministry that the Holy Spirit might require of me to become a public figure again. I left that to him. So that motivation is removed. So the only motivation I have left for writing books is simply because I have something valuable to say. Now, all the biographies of Jack that have been written lean very heavily on speculation and the speculation of the biographer. Now, my biography will be a simple recounting of what happened in Jack's life as I learned of it from him and others. And it will be a stark and fairly brutal biography. But it will show the workings of the Holy Spirit throughout his life. You see, everything I have ever done in my life has been training for the ministry I'm in today. Everything that Jack ever did in his life was training for his eventual ministry, which was one of literature. So yes, I will rewrite it, and then I will seek out a publisher. So. No, I didn't say anything of the sort. I do not advocate Christian public education. I don't even know what that is. And nor do I speak of disdain of what? I don't speak with disdain of the state church either. I don't think there is one, is there? Do you have a state church in this country? No, that's not a state church. That's a worldwide church. The problem with Anglicanism simply is that it has ceased to be, in many cases, a gospel-preaching church. It has become so liberalized that they... I mean, there was an Anglican bishop who got up the other day and said, well, I don't really believe in the resurrection, you know. It was symbolic and all that. And I don't really believe in the virgin birth, you know, symbolic and all that. Well, I'm here to say that's bullshit. If there is no resurrection, there is no Christianity. If there is no resurrection, there is no Christianity. If there is no virgin birth, there is no Christianity. It's nonsense. A church that will do that is dead and only walking around to save funeral expenses. I'm sorry, I should have turned around before. The question is whether how much my mother's influence the lead character in Until We Have Faces. Jack always said that my mother's input for that book was so great that it should have been titled as a collaboration between the two of them. She always said that all she ever did was teach him how to write more like himself and to write from a feminine perspective. So I think probably the truth lies somewhere in midway between those two. Certainly my mother's influence is very noticeable in the book, particularly for some people who knew my mother. It's there. It is a book that many women have told me is extremely rare for a male writer to be able to write so well from a feminine perspective. So yes, my mother had a great deal of influence on that book. Lady up here on the side. The letters from Jack to my mother have not been published. Many of them were accidentally destroyed. In the collections of letters which are going to be published, we're going to do fairly soon a very extensive collection of letters. I think it'll wind up 3 volumes. If we did them all, it would be something like 7 or 8. Many would be just repetitious. But no, I think most of the... I don't think that Jack's letters to my mother will be published, mainly because they were never significant. The early ones were, but the later ones were just, you know, back Sunday, love Jack, you know, things like that. Up here, please. I would qualify my statements by saying I know that there are great teachers striving and working desperately hard within that system. But I do believe the system needs to be totally renewed. I don't believe that with the very best efforts that you put in, and I'm sure you do, and having met you this evening, I have the greatest respect for you as a person, but I do not believe that within the governmental interference you suffer from, that your teaching talents will ever be fully utilized. Please. That would take me a book to answer. Well, I will ask you the question, who does the fox represent? And my answer is Satan. What evidence do you have to assume that Orwell is ugly? The answer is none. There are all kinds of nuances. There are all kinds of pieces of knowledge that come through. It would take ages and ages. We would have to discuss this for hours to sort that out. Well, I'm afraid we don't have time tonight. Please. My Jewishness, how has that played a part in being a Christian lecturer and my Christian lifestyle? That's a very interesting question. That's one I haven't really thought about. I've never regarded my Jewishness as being part of my environmental training. It's an accident of birth. I don't really know the answer to that, except perhaps that being Jewish has led me to have no ability to be a racist. I have been accused once on Mia Lewis, in fact, which is the internet discussion group about Lewis, of being a racist. But I am half Jewish, on two sides of the family with my relations with Jews. I'm something of a Cherokee Indian, I don't know quite how much, part Scottish and part English. My youngest son is married to a Chinese girl, and I have a Korean daughter. So just who do you want me to pick on, you know? I think probably it gives me a deeper understanding of the Holocaust and what it meant to the Jewish people. It gives me probably a deeper understanding of what it is like to be persecuted, all of those things. But honestly, I have never really concentrated and thought about the question before. Please. I don't think I've finished realizing it yet. But certainly I knew that Jack was a great influence on my life from the time of his death. So I would have been 18 at the time. Just how much he has influenced my life, I don't think I'll know till they nail the last nail in my coffin.
I'm going to permit two more questions, and then we'll call an end to the evening.
Let me first just say that I do apologize for the clumsiness of my remarks about public education. I was not criticizing the teachers, because I don't believe that what is happening is the teachers' fault at all. I don't want you to think that I think that American teachers are any worse or better than necessarily than any other teachers. I think there are fine teachers here, but I think you're hamstrung by the environment in which you're forced to work. I think if you cannot lead a prayer in your classrooms, something is wrong with your system. Question where? Yes, sir, please. Well, don't rubbish the Puritans too far. They have an awful lot of things right, you know. Yes, certainly. And I go along with that. I agree with you. I'm beginning to realize that. I'm not sure that I advocate him. I simply like some of the stuff he says. I love his humor, and that's why I use it. If I quote Julius Caesar, it doesn't mean that I admire the man necessarily. I thought that was what I'd been preaching all evening. Where is your challenge? I'm sorry, I don't understand. Irreverence to whom? It certainly isn't irreverence to God. It is in irreverence to your church, perhaps. But I will make no apology for that. I have given myself, my life, everything I own, everything I earn, everything I am to Jesus Christ for his use. God requires of me my life. I have nothing more to give. I'm still not quite sure I understand the question, but let's go on to this lady. C.S. Lewis lost his mother when he was a young child. Did he ever share that with me in my loss? I think he shared it with me in my loss in as much as he understood what I was feeling. He made one bad mistake about that, incidentally. He didn't understand my embarrassment when he talked about her. He didn't understand why I was embarrassed. But the fact of the matter is, when you're brought up in the British public school system, the first thing you're taught is that boys don't cry. And the very worst thing that can ever happen to a British schoolboy is to be seen crying in public. And I always knew that if he started talking about my mother, I would cry. And I would be seen to be crying, and that would be the most horrible embarrassment that could happen to me. That's why I was embarrassed. That's the only mistake he made about it. But he did something incredibly brave, and that was that he took me and told me my mother was going to die. No one ever told him. He was in bed with a toothache, and he was crying for her, and she didn't come to him. He never understood why until afterwards, when she was already dead. If you have a situation where you have children and your wife or husband is approaching death, tell your children. Don't leave them wondering what on earth is going on. Don't leave them to live in terror for those weeks, knowing that something is wrong, but not what. Tell them. Trust them with the facts. Do them the honor of realizing that they have the capacity to understand, and they have the capacity, if you tell them, to absorb the information and to cushion themselves against the blow when it comes. They told me my mother was dying, and I appreciated it. Nobody ever told me Jack was dying, and I was so angry about that. I really was, and so hurt. I was 18 at that stage, and still they didn't think it was good for me to be told. That was a shock. It hit me harder than my mother's death, because I knew my mother was dying. Tell your children, please.
We're going to need to wrap it up.
Thank you very much for your patience. Let me just tell you one thing. When people applaud a talk like this, it is very easy to me to fall into the temptation of thinking what a good speaker I am or what a good chap I am, but I am not. I have nothing to say without the Holy Spirit of God, so give the glory to him in your prayers tonight. Thank you very much. Good night.